You are listening to Teaching Boys and Teaching Girls Towards a Better Understanding by Andrew Pudua, conference code B1. This message was recorded live at the 2021 Nebraska Christian Home Educators Association Conference and Curriculum Fair in Lincoln, Nebraska. The Nebraska Christian Home Educators Association has been supporting and defending homeschooling in Nebraska for several decades. For more information about the NCHEA or homeschooling in Nebraska, please visit our website at nchea.org. The NCHEA has been given limited copyright to sell copies of this message for personal use only. Please avoid unauthorized use and distribution of this message.
I hope you had a little bit of lunch and relaxation and shopping. My name is Andrew Pudua, and this talk is entitled Teaching Boys and Girls Towards a New Understanding. So, many years ago, probably when I was here, I had a talk called Teaching Boys and Other Children Who Would Rather Be Making Forts All Day. And that was kind of a two-part talk, and over the years it just got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger to the point where I could never, ever finish. So I cut it in half, and I took the second half and made a talk called Principles of Motivation. And then the first half of the talk I changed into this one. So if you heard that talk, you will hear some things again. I used to always worry about people hearing the same thing twice or three times. And then I realized we all forget most of what we hear. So there's nothing terrible about hearing the same thing a second or third time. And sometimes it's even helpful because it reminds you of something that you kind of knew but gives better clarification. But if you do find this to be too redundant to a talk that you have previously heard me give, feel free to leave and I won't feel bad at all. So I had the great privilege many years ago, I guess it's pushing 20 years now, of being a co-presenter at a Catholic schools conference in Atlanta, which is a little bit unusual venue for me. But I was delighted to go and see what I could do to help out. The other speaker there was a man by the name of Leonard Sachs. Dr. Leonard Sachs, spelled S-A-X, just like saxophone. And he gave a four-hour presentation, and I was rapt. I was so focused in. I took pages and pages and pages of notes. I was so excited by what he was doing, because he was giving the science, the research, to support what I had already experienced as true. And I don't know about you, but I do tend to get excited when science supports the truth. Doesn't always happen these days. But in this case, I was rapt. And Sachs spent this 4 hours, and I got this information. I started sharing it with homeschoolers and other people I knew, and it gradually developed into this talk. But it's just a small fraction of the research that's available. So I'm going to mention Dr. Sachs's books, but I want to give you a caveat right off that you may read one or more of these books or look at it, and there will be things you disagree with. There were things I disagreed with. Dr. Sachs has a kind of different worldview than I do. As far as I know, he's a non-practicing Jew. He is an MD and a PhD in psychology. Tremendously brilliant man. But there are things he says that you will find not perfectly in harmony with your overall belief system. And that's okay. Just don't get mad at me. You know, it's so funny. I recommend a book. People read the book and say, how could you recommend this book? It says blah, blah, blah. What a horrible thing. I don't know any books that I agree with 100%. I know a few I probably should agree with 100%, but I don't know any that I do. So, you know, take it with a grain of salt. But I find his work refreshing because he doesn't have a political agenda. He doesn't have a religious agenda. He has a truth agenda. And that has created a lot of enemies for him. But he got started in this business when he was working as a pediatrician in his little corner of the world, which was Baltimore, I think, Maryland area. And this was back in the early 90s. He noticed a rapidly increasing incidence of moms coming into his office with little boys, presenting him with a note from the school that said, "We believe this child has an attention deficit issue. Would you please prescribe an appropriate medication?" Dr. Sachs would then evaluate the child medically, conclude that no, he looks like a pretty normal, healthy boy, and decline to prescribe the medication. Those same mothers would appear in his office a few weeks later with the same child and another note from the school saying, "We really, really believe this child needs medication. Would you reconsider?" And Sachs began to wonder, do teachers in schools know what most doctors know about little boys? And that is, quite honestly, little boys do not hear as soft of sounds as little girls. This is well documented. And I think most moms figure this out really quickly. Sometimes even before they have their own boys, because they married one. So Sachs collected up some of the research that he had come across over his years in medical school and after, and he gathered this, and he went into public schools and presented this research to teachers and administrators. And what he found, two things. No one in any public school that he talked to had ever heard anything like this before. And number two, no one wanted to hear this. It flew in the face of the programming of the psychology of teacher education, which for many years, even back in the 90s, had been, boys and girls are exactly the same. There are no sex-based or gender-based differences. Any differences you do see are simply individual variants, and it is categorically wrong to make generalizations in this way. The problem is, there are some very, very valid statistical generalizations. Of course, there's always exceptions. So, if I say most boys do not hear as soft of sounds as most girls, certainly there's a range and there would be an overlap. There would be some boys who hear softer sounds than some girls, but we're talking supermajority level of statistical validity to the generalization. Do you see? So we have to be a little careful. But it evidently starts at birth. So Sachs went in, he saw what was going on, he continued to research and look into different areas, and he moved past hearing into vision, and then into stress and pain. And what he discovered is there are some profound differences that in the way that boys and girls hear and see and handle stress and pain. And if you can understand that, you can teach them both better. And the result of Sachs's investigation and work was his first book called Why Gender Matters. And if you buy this book, I would strongly recommend you try to get the first edition, probably used, rather than the second edition, because the first edition had a whole lot more about teaching and schools and classrooms and education. The second edition, he had to leave out a lot of that because he wanted to put in some newer things. And he's moved much more into a different area now. But that first edition was, it was earth-shaking. I went to his talk, I bought the book, I read it. I was just amazed. And I'm going to give you just the tip of the iceberg of the research. So if you want to see more of it, go to that book, Why Gender Matters, First Edition is Better. So Sachs ended up creating an organization called the Association for Single-Sex Public Education. This is a horrible name for an organization. He should never have done that. But, you know, in the 90s, who knew what URLs and internet verbiage would become. And he operated a national convention, basically for teachers in schools that wanted to separate boys and girls and teach them separately. And there's a lot of challenges when you do that. There's resistance from parents, there's resistance from teachers, there's political resistance, there's all sorts of things that you have to overcome if indeed you want to try this experiment. And so he has traveled around the world supporting and teaching in this context. However, he was basically taken out by the ACLU, who slandered him and basically lied about him to the point where the organization fell apart, and he's continued his work more now in the world of parenting than of education. And his subsequent books were Boys Adrift, The Factors Undermining the Success of Young Men in America Today. His next book was called Girls on the Edge. And then his last book, most recently, was called The Collapse of Parenting. And as I said, he doesn't have an agenda other than what does the research say. And so I appreciate that. So I'm just going to, with that little introduction, I'm going to dive in and just share with you some of the information he shared with us, and we'll see how it fits with your life experience. So this business of hearing evidently starts at birth, because the first research he presented had to do with newborns and looking at the cochlea, the part of the ear system that actually vibrates in response to sound, and then that vibration is carried in through the auditory nerve in the brain that decodes it. And here what they found is that in 350 cases, the female newborns, their cochlea were responding to sound on an average 3 times softer on the decibel scale than boys. And that is because the female physiology, they have smaller, more stiffer and tightly packed cells that are just better conductors of the sound waves than in the male physiology. So that kind of indicates it can't possibly be conditioning, because the argument is always boys and girls are different because you treat them differently, rather than there could be some actual physiological differences between males and females. With children a little bit older, toddler age, they have what was called acoustic brain response. Now it's usually called fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging. And this is a fascinating technology where you can actually take a picture of the neural activity that's going on under different circumstances and stimuli. And here they found that children, 2-3 years old, the females, many of them were hearing sounds up to 10 times softer on the decibel scale than boys of a corresponding age. This difference in hearing, as we get older, we are generally able to compensate for that. But it evidently carries the fact that we are different carries on all the way through life. In fact, this study kind of made everyone chuckle. This was done with college students at a university in Virginia, and they were testing to see, again, with fMRI technology, what's happening in the brains when people listen to audiobooks. And here they found that women, these are all adults, women listening to audiobooks generally have neurons and neural activity happening in both hemispheres of their cortex, whereas men listening to audiobooks have a whole lot of activity in only one hemisphere. That would be the language executive function side, and way less activity in the other hemisphere of the cortex. And that was, the majority of men and women were different. Now, this actually supports a suspicion that many women have long had, which is that men are listening with half their brain most of the time. Don't you love it when science supports you? Now, of course, you think about children and hearing. Now imagine, you're a little boy. You're in a classroom. You don't hear everything clearly. Or you hear some people but not other people clearly. Or you hear some days but not other days better because the barometric pressure changed. Or because of what you did or did not eat. Or because of the air quality. There are so many things that affect the neurological function of young children. Very variable. But let's say you're a little boy and you're there and you can't hear well. Of course you would have an attention problem. If I was there and I couldn't hear well, I would leave. But you can't do that when you're in a prison. I mean, a classroom. You're stuck. You can't go anywhere. And then life becomes about how to not die of boredom. Do you remember when you were young, and maybe there's a few young people in the room, do you remember when you actually believed that it was possible to die of boredom? And you thought, if this continues, I simply will explode. But somehow you survive it. But life is about that, how to survive boredom. For me, my strongest memory of school, other than dodgeball, is surviving boredom. And I had tricks. One of my favorite tricks was a holding the breath contest with yourself. In my school, when I was a kid, you had one of those clocks that had a second hand on the wall. They don't use those anymore because people don't learn how to read clocks. But I had a second hand. And I remember sitting there hundreds, thousands of times, just seeing how long I could hold my breath. Whoa, 1 minute, 42 seconds. Bet I can beat that. And I would just do this because there was nothing else to do. And there were other little tricks. I don't know, do any of you remember having to come up with little tricks to not die of boredom in school? And so you would think, okay, here's a boy, and if he can't hear well, he will have an attention problem. And sometimes just increasing the volume that you're speaking at can go far in reaching a child who's just not getting, not tuned in, not there. I have long noticed that when I teach children, if I speak loud enough to fully engage the boys, the poor girl sitting next to him thinks I'm yelling. It is not uncommon for a wife to say to her husband, "You're yelling at our daughter. You're yelling at the kids." A husband, "I am not yelling. I am speaking clearly. They need to know." No, you're yelling. There are other things that manifest behaviorally. Some of them can be kind of irritating. For example, I don't know if you've ever noticed, but there are boys who can make little noises. And they make little noises, and they irritate you profoundly. But the boys don't actually notice that they're making a noise. And so they're making the noise, and you will say something like, "Would you please stop that?" The boy's like, "Stop what?" And you're like, "Stop that." "Oh, I am so sorry. I did not notice." And so what we notice, what we see then, is that if we understand that the boys need more volume and they need to be auditorily engaged with a greater level of intensity than most girls, that helps us tremendously. And so we can't be afraid then to vary ourselves. I have also, for many years, even before I met Dr. Sachs, I have tried to get the boys on one side and the girls are on the other. People would come into my class and I would tell them where to sit. I know this is awfully dictatorial, but I would say, "Hey, you come sit here with these guys and you go sit here with her. And hey, you come over on this side and I think you could sit over here." I try to get the boys on one side and the girls on the other. And then I can go stand near the boys. I can pound on the table, shout. And they're totally like, this is cool. And the girls are all there, perfectly safe. Vision. Now this is by far way more interesting to me because this has a very direct impact on what I teach in terms of writing to children. But not in the way you might think. Evidently, males and females, men and women, boys and girls, see differently. We see different things when we look at things. I have long suspected that my wife and I see different things when we look at the same thing. But I didn't really understand that until I met Dr. Sachs and he explained the physiology of it. It's fascinating. So this is actually true for mammals. So all mammals, not just people, but you see this in most mammal species. That the retina is connected to the optic nerve. Now, once upon a time, you probably got a class and learned about the cells in the retina that process light information. They're called rods and cones. Do you remember learning about rods and cones? Now, what you may not have learned or may not remember is that the rods and cones process different types of light. The rods are larger cells, and they process information having to do with speed and direction, i.e. movement. The cones are smaller cells, and they process information having to do with color and texture. Then, because we have two eyes and we have convergence of vision and depth perception, we see everything that is visible to us as humans as movement, speed, direction, speed, color, texture, and depth and distance. Now, what's interesting then is that males, male mammals, most all of them, have more M cells connected to the rods in the optic nerve that connects to the retina, and most females have more P cells connected to the cones. Therefore, most males process information having to do with speed and direction with greater impact or vibrancy or clarity, and most females process information having to do with color and texture with greater vibrancy or impact or clarity. This is observable biologically, but it is reinforced by observing behavior. It is reinforced behaviorally. Several studies Sachs mentioned, I'll just mention a couple. One had to do with newborns and where they would focus their vision. So they put, they had newborn babies, hospital just born, put in a crib, and on one side of the crib was a spinning metallic mobile. And on the other side of the crib was a real live young woman with a pretty face. And then impartial observers behind glass who did not know the sex of the baby would record their observations as to where that baby appeared to be focusing their vision during that short period of being awake. And what did they discover? Almost all the boys were looking at the spinning metallic mobile, and almost all the girls were looking at the young woman's pretty face. Why? Because they could see it better. They could see it more easily. Newborns don't see all that much to begin with. So they will walk onto the thing which is easiest to see, the higher contrasting image. And for the boys, it was that movement. For the girls, it was that color, texture, and beauty. Another observation Sachs made, and I have seen this so many times in my own children, other people's children, maybe you've had this experience too, and it's not universally absolute, but it's definitely common, is when you observe children drawing pictures. So let's say, and I ran a preschool for a few years, so I had a lot of other people's children, all 3, 4, 5 years old to observe, and then I have my own kids. But if you observe children drawing pictures, very often you will discover that the boys are attempting to draw verbs, movement. They're attempting to draw things that are in motion. For example, arrows arcing across the sky, or bullets coming out of a gun, or crashes, like a car crash, or explosions, right? Girls are very often trying to draw things, nouns, right? So rainbows, flowers, horses, faces, horses, horses, a lot of horses. And one of the problems, of course, is that verbs look better, nouns look better than verbs. So, here's a typical situation. Sack says, you know, any teacher could fall into this trap. I probably have. Got a nice teacher. She has been, you know, trained in child psychology and early childhood development. And maybe she even had an arts methods class or something. Now she sees two children. She comes over and says, "Hey, Billy, that's a great picture you've got going there. I really like it. What is it?" And Billy very excitedly says, "Well, it was a rocket ship, and it took off, and then it crashed into an asteroid, and it broke into a million pieces, and it's falling all over Lake Michigan." And he's used one color, probably black. And the teacher will try to be encouraging. Say, "Well, that's a lovely idea. Now, you know, Billy, next time you want to draw a rocket ship or a space, I have a book over here, and you're welcome to take a look, and you can, you know, see how you might like to draw your rockets. And, you know, if you used a little more color in your drawing would be more colorful." And then she goes over and she looks at Sally's drawing and says, "Oh, Sally, that's beautiful. I love how you've got the house with the chimney and the smoke on top, and then, you know, the forest on the side, and the flowers in the front, and the rainbow in the back, and the horse on the front lawn." That's just... And Sally's used every color in the box. It doesn't take Billy very long to figure, teacher likes that, doesn't like this. And Sachs made a claim. I think this is a bold claim, but I understand his logic, and I probably agree with it. He said, it is more valuable to separate boys and girls in the primary grades, K-1-2, than it is in high school. Now, there are many reasons as to why it is academically and socially beneficial to separate boys and girls in high school. But he said it's the first few years of school where children make decisions that affect them for the rest of their life. If a child compares himself with another child and says, "Well, I'm not that good, I'm not good like that," he can say, "Well, I'm not good, so I shouldn't do it," and start to shut down. This happened to me. I do not know exactly when, nor do I blame anyone at all, but I do know in my life, at a very young age, probably 7 or 8 years old, I decided that I am bad at drawing pictures and I should never do it. And so I just stopped. I just refused to draw pictures. I never wanted to draw pictures. I just quit. And then, of course, you know, you suffer through, you know, an additional 8, 9, 10 years or what of being in school. And they force you periodically into an art class where they then try to brainwash you into thinking that you are good at something you're not good at. At which point you just suffer through it like any other kind of purgatorial experience. You just, you know. But I was never convinced that I could ever draw anything because I made that decision very young. I don't fault anyone at all, but I have personal experience. To this day, I cannot draw a sick person that looks like a sick person. That's how bad I am. But Sachs's research goes further, and it's so fascinating to me because the way that we see the world actually affects the language we use. Sachs cited one study. This was done with college students again. And it was comparing the writing of men and women, the creative writing of college students. And there are many different rubrics and scales and methods that people use to evaluate or quantify writing. Everything from, you know, things like idea density, how many ideas do you fit in per certain number of words, to things like descriptor categories, what are the tendencies of this writer? And there's others, but this descriptor category is very interesting because what they found is that if you read most women's creative writing, the more powerful descriptors, or you might say the keywords that carry the most weight in a sentence, tended to be adjectives and nouns. Most men's writing, the powerful descriptors tended to be verbs and adverbs. And you see this reflected in the real world of adults, because if you walk into any public school, you're most likely to find a woman teaching, particularly in the elementary grades, right? They're very, very much women dominated. And you will see a teacher teaching writing, and her little dialogue may go something like this. Now, children, in order to make your writing more interesting and colorful, we use these things called adjectives. And you teach a whole lesson on adjectives, right? I have actually been challenged by school teachers. Even as recently as a year ago, someone wrote to me, "Why do you teach LY adverb first? You should teach adjective first." Because in our stylistic techniques, that's the order. LY adverb is always first. Well, why? Well, I have noticed that children in general, and boys in particular, are much more in tune with the amplification of movement than they are of object. You can almost see a change in attitude just by one word difference when you're talking to kids. If you say, "Hey son, this is a pretty good story you've got going here. Would you like me to help you add in a little more detail?" The answer is very likely to be, "No, not really. Isn't it good enough? Can I go play now?" Change one word. "Hey son, this is a pretty good story you've got going here. Would you like me to help you add in a little more action?" Okay, that might be cool. Complete shift. I have long noticed that our writing classes, while they're good for everyone, my super sweet spot is reluctant writer boys. Because the very first thing we do in terms of style addition, they connect with immediately. And not only did it change the way that I could talk to kids and my expectation, it also helped tremendously in my marriage. Because I have totally blown it on a few occasions. When we moved to California, we bought a house that needed a lot of remodeling because it was like super cheap, but it ended up being super expensive. But nevertheless, you know, the money pit saga. Anyway, so we're living in this one house while we're trying to remodel this other house. And I am like working like crazy to try and make money as fast as possible to help pay for this thing. But my wife's pretty much doing all of the decisions. I don't know if you've ever remodeled a house, but it's a lot of decisions, right? And she's just at, what is it called? Decision fatigue, I hear. My daughter who's in medical school tells me this is a real thing now, decision fatigue. And I think my wife hit this moment because one evening she said to me, "Sweetheart, could you help me make a decision?" "Sure." So she lays out on the floor three tiles. These are about, you know, 1 foot square bathroom tiles or something. And there's three of them. And she says, "Which one would you like best for the master bathroom?" So I look at the three tiles. And with absolutely no guile nor malintent whatsoever, I said, honestly, "I really don't care." This was the wrong thing to say because I think it was the straw that broke her down because she burst into tears and said, "I'm working so hard to make this a nice house for us and you won't even tell me which tiles you like." I'm like, "Sweetheart, I did not mean to hurt you at all. But after I met Sax, I knew the problem. I couldn't tell the difference. They were just marble tiles. I lived in that house for almost 10 years. I could not begin to describe to you what the bathroom tiles looked like. Not even remotely in the color zone. I had an almost worse time thing happen. I went on a trip. I came home. I walked in the master bedroom, my bedroom. I looked around and I thought, something is different. My wife comes in. Did you notice anything different? I said, well, you cleaned up a bit. She said, well, that's because I painted the walls. Evidently, the walls of the bedroom had gone from some yellowish off-white to a more bluish off-white. I could have lived the rest of my life and never figured that out. But knowing the information now, and you men, you have a secret tool now in your toolbox, because it happened again. We moved to Oklahoma. We built a house. We were living in this little shack while she's building the house. She had to make all the decisions. She tried the exact same trick on me. She laid out three tiles and said, which one do you like? Now, I knew what to do. I looked at the three tiles. And I picked one at random. And I said, well, I kind of like this one here on the left, but which one were you thinking would be best? Now, if she likes the one I picked, I lucked out. I'm in there. If she says, well, I was kind of thinking this one, then you just backtrack a little bit and say, yeah. You know, looking a little more closely, I do see that is a very... Let's go with that one together. And now we walk a lot because we have new children. We're trying to, you know, keep our trim figure. And it's a constant dialogue of colors analysis of everybody's house in the neighborhood. I have about three colors for red that I could actually name, and she's got at least a dozen. But that's okay. We see differently. But when you understand, it can be very, very helpful. Another fascinating area is stress. Do you think that there's stress involved in educating children? Yes, on all counts, right? And this is really interesting to me because evidently males and females, and it's true for mammals, not just humans, but male and female mammals, have a different response to stress. In males, the initial reaction is what we would probably call the fight or flight response. You've heard that, right? Fight or flight. That's the initial reaction to stress for males, and it activates the sympathetic nervous system, thereby increasing the heart rate, increasing blood flow, increasing body temperature, and it is moderated or regulated by movement. Standing up and or moving around. Females, their initial response is the opposite. It is not fight or flight. It could be called tend and befriend or hide and disappear. The initial response is to kind of shut down. So it activates the parasympathetic nervous system, causing a decrease in heart rate, a decrease in blood flow, possibly a decrease in body temperature. They may become nauseous or dizzy, and they handle this. This is regulated by sitting or lying down. It takes a higher threshold of stress to send a female into a fight or flight response. Now this kind of describes my children quite well. When my son, when he was maybe 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, that range, when he was stressed or upset, everyone knew it. Where's my knife? I can't find my knife. My knife is missing. My knife is gone. She took my knife. Where is it? Calm down. She didn't take your knife. She doesn't care about knives. We can find your knife, but we will have to go through some steps of figuring out where you have been. But he's just blowing off stress, right? The girls, when they were stressed, first you have to find them. They're on the couch, blanket over the head. It could be 80 degrees in the house, they still have the blanket over the head. Is something wrong?
Yes, no, I don't know. Leave me alone.
Did something bad happen to you?
I don't know, just leave me alone.
Can I help you?
Just leave me alone.
What do you do with that? Personally, I would prefer the tantrum. You can negotiate with a tantrum. That? Nothing. Get their mother. It's the only one. But we may be giving boys mixed messages. For example, sit down and do your hard math. Hold on. For the boy, remaining seated for any significant period of time takes almost all the energy they have. To then demand doing math on top of it may be unreasonable. In fact, you might actually get a better result if you said, "Son, stand at the counter and do some math." Dr. Sachs told this amusing story about a school he was working with, and they had separated the boys and the girls and done it in a very interesting, I think, potentially brilliant way. But they took the grade 1-2 and split them boys and girls, and then they had a grade 1-2 boys combo and a grade 1-2 girls combo classes, which I think in every aspect is a far superior teaching environment. But he went to visit the school, and he said the grade 1-2 boys teacher, very wisely, had made chairs optional. In other words, you could have one if you wanted one, but nobody's going to make you sit in one. He said, there wasn't a boy in the room sitting in the chair. They're all lined up against the wall. And the boys are kind of hunched over their desk, doing their work, dancing around, or caved in under the desk, secret agent style. That school, by creating intentionally boy-friendly and girl-friendly environments, doubled their test score, expected test score increase, by changing the environment and the teaching methods that were available. So, you will notice that boys often can think better on their feet. I know I think better on my feet. In fact, when I get a phone call and it's going to require me to answer a hard question or make a hard decision or get information, if I don't have to write stuff down, I'll usually stand up and walk around with a, you know, phone attached to my ear rather than sit down and do that. My wife, however, clearly is in favor of sitting because she will say stuff to me like, "Sweetheart, we need to talk. Sit down." My immediate mental response is, "For how long?" But now I know. Next tip. When she says, "Sweetheart, we need to talk," I say, "Great, let's take a walk." Because, of course, she wants to keep her trim figure. And I think better on my feet, so I get the upper hand in the negotiation. So we want to be, I think, a little flexible in understanding that in homeschooling, we do not have to force this, you know, sitting at desk all day. My father, before he passed on, probably at least 24 times in the last 10 years of his life, went out of his way to tell me, "I remember school. It was painful. Just sitting in the chair was painful." I don't know. Can you believe that? I feel like I remember. Pain, of course, is another interesting thing, and this may possibly be a justification for forcing boys to sit in chairs. I don't know. But evidently, males and females, men and women, have very different response to pain. This particular study I'm going to mention, which I believe was done at a university in Florida with college students, would be an indicator as to why, if you go to a college and someone wants to offer you $100 or $200 to participate in a research project, be a little inquisitive before you sign on the dotted line, because this experiment tested pain thresholds and neurophysiological response. So as I understand it, the way it worked is they would put a little balloon-like thing in your body where you should not put little balloon-like things, and expand this little balloon-like thing to a point where it super, super really hurt a lot, at which point the subject would say, I give up, I can't take any more stuff. And they would take a snapshot of what's going on in the brain and the body at that moment, and what did they find? 100% of the men, pain caused an increase of blood flow to the brain. 100% of the women, pain caused a decrease of blood flow to the brain. Orientation notwithstanding. That's pretty extreme. But it makes sense if you look at like the survival of the race. For most of history, most men have been out doing stuff with their body, right? Building, hunting, working, farming, and possibly getting hurt, and needing to have the presence of mind to get home and get nursed. In fact, you will find memoirs of soldiers who will say things like, when the bullet hit, it clarified my thinking, I knew exactly what to do. I was listening on NPR just a few months ago to this horrible story of this guy who basically had a water ski accident where the propeller of the boat cut like this huge gashes into his leg, and I mean, it's an awful story, but he said the same thing. He said it was like everything slowed down. It was crystal clear what I needed to do to survive. Sack said in all his years of being a doctor and reading medical stuff, he has never yet heard a woman say, pain clarified my thinking. If anything, it does the opposite, which is fortunate for the survival of the species. Because if women actually remembered pain, the whole thing would have stopped after the first generation, because all the women would have said, no, never again is that ever going to happen to me, no matter what, go away forever. So it's a good thing you get all a little fuzzy. And Sachs said a pretty interesting thing. He would never put this in a book, but he was talking to a particular audience, and so he said, that's why sometimes spanking boys can be helpful, because they get a little bit of pain and then they think, oh, yes, that was a stupid thing that I did. But you should probably never spank girls, because that pain, they go all fuzzy and then they kind of are thinking, you hit me and I don't even know what I did anymore. So, other potential consequences. But this also explains things like airsoft. So my son lived for airsoft. I don't know if you women know about airsoft, but this is where you go out with essentially BB guns with really big plastic bullets that can come out really fast, and when they hit you, it hurts. In fact, I was tricked into playing airsoft once with a whole bunch of teenagers. I came out, you know, in a t-shirt, and they all had on, you know, triple thickness camo. And I thought, it's a hot day, why are you overdressed? And then I realized, but my son would go play airsoft. He's around, when he was 10, 11 years old, that was the whole existence. That was the reason for living, was to play airsoft with friends. He would come home from airsoft day, rip off his shirt, and show off his bruises. Well, Tommy got me there, and Peter got me there, and Nikki hit me here, but I got him right between the eyes. And the mom is sitting there thinking, I hope you are wearing your goggles. And the girls, the sisters, are appalled. They can't quite believe this. Like, why would anyone do that? See, this is also part of it. You have to build bridges. How many of you have boys and girls at home or in your same class? So you've got to build some bridges, right? And so you have a situation. You got a little boy and he's making all these noises, right? And you go over and you say, son, hold on a minute. No, what first happens is complaint. The sister complains, right? So she says, Mom, will you please tell him to stop it? Because it's so irritating and I just can't think or concentrate at all. So you go to the boy and you say, Son, I realize you're a boy and you are clueless that you make little noises with your body, which irritate me and your sister. So we're going to have a system. When you're making a little noise with your body, I'm going to wave two fingers in the air. And when you see me waving two fingers in the air, that means you're making a noise with your body. So you look around and see what part of your body is moving. And you try to hold it still for a while. Because the sound does irritate me and your sister. And self-control is a good thing to develop. And I hate to say it, but you may have to marry one of us someday. And you go to the girl and you say, he's a boy. He's clueless. He has no idea he's making noises. It's not to irritate us. He just doesn't know. Now I've set up a system with him. We're going to work on this. But you need to be a little less hypersensitive, a little less reactive, a little more tolerant, because, let's face it, you may have to marry one of them someday. You know, the boy will want to wrestle and punch and pinch and kick his sister. This is natural. But it's not good, right? I mean, we should have learned this lesson, but it appears natural. It's not always good. Anyway, you go to the boy, again, building bridges, and you say, Son, she's a girl. She does not actually enjoy the feeling of being punched and kicked and pinched and wrestled to the ground. If you want to show your love to her, you tell her she looks pretty. Or ask her a question about what she's doing. But don't do that. Save it for when your dad comes home. Then the two of you can just beat the heck out of each other and we won't care. You go to the girl and you say, look, he's a boy. This is how boys show their liking of each other. This is how they show love and affection. By punching and pinching and kicking and wrestling. The worst thing you could do is pinch back or kick back, because then he's going to think you like this. We'll set up a system. We'll try to separate it. And then dad comes home. I remember my son about 13. After he'd kind of moved out of his airsoft is everything phase, he went into this short, I will hurt my dad. I will physically harm him. This was his goal. And so we would get going at it. And it was full out pro wrestling stuff. It was like, bam, bam, boom, whoosh. And he's really trying to hurt me. And I'm trying to hurt him just enough so he gives up on trying to hurt me without him ending in the hospital. And the girls are horrified. They're like, they're hurting each other for reals. Yes, that is what we are doing. If you don't let boys hurt each other, they will go hurt themselves. My wife came to me one day with great concern. And she said, sweetheart, our son is biting himself a lot. I said, so? And she said, well, I mean, like, a lot. I mean, he's just biting him so you can see the teeth marks and everything. As if this was some kind of self-harm symptom or something. And I said to her, well, when I was that age, I used to bite myself a lot. Didn't you? She said, no. One of the things you would do to not die of boredom in school. Like, whoa, cool teeth marks, but I could go deeper. Yeah. To this day, when I'm driving, if I get a little drowsy, I'm just full out as hard as I can. Bam, bam. Upon inquiry, I discovered she never slaps herself in the face to stay awake. I was so surprised. Her secret technique of staying awake on long drives, she has a stash of almonds and she eats them very slowly to stay. Has this been helpful? a lot more that could be said. Sachs has actually done some more recent research on smell. And this is really frightening, but I'm absolutely sure it's true. Females will learn and identify smells and be emotionally affected by smells through repetition by a magnitude of thousands difference. So, as I understand it, the first time a man and woman smell something, they smell kind of the same level. The second time, the man smells or doesn't smell the same thing, but the woman experiences it more intense. And the third time, more and more and more, up to a point where it can be 10,000 times more intense. And there are probably some, I don't know, I wouldn't say evolutionary, but there's some maybe biological reasons to this. But I'm very sure that if most teenage boys understood this, they would probably rethink their philosophy of showering. Sachs went to an all-girls school in Australia, and they were planning a dance with a boys' school. And the girl's like, "We don't want to go." And Sachs says, "Well, why don't you want to go?" She goes, "They all stink." He went over to the boys' school, said, "I'm going to tell you a secret here. These girls smell you, even though none of you smell you." I had a daughter once, Julia. She could pick up any piece of clothing in the house, smell it, and know whose clothing it was. "Even can you do that?" I thought, I can no more do that than fly to the moon, you know. So there's a lot more could be said. I guess what we're facing today is the challenge that it's almost not acceptable to even claim that there are boys and girls. And I think that makes everyone's conversation about how to teach children more difficult. So Sachs has spent the last bit of time, and if you're interested, I recorded a podcast with Dr. Sachs about a year ago, and I highly recommend it. You just go to iw.com/podcast, or our podcast is called the Arts of Language Podcast. You can get it on all the platforms. And search for Sachs, S-A-S. And what he was talking about is really, where are we now in the... We're no longer just a little bit confused about why gender matters. We are profoundly confused as a society. And this has no upside potential for children and teaching children. So you might take a look into it. We have maybe 2 minutes for a question or two. Does anyone have anything that is they're just itching to ask me about any of that? Nothing? Yes. My youngest child just turned 21. She got married at 18. She has a one-year-old and lives about 300 yards from my house. And it's the joy of my life. And she's the only one of my children who still works for IEW full-time. So, from home with a one-year-old. Yeah. 14 grandchildren. Yes?
So what if your girl has more characteristics like you were describing, beating up on the little brother or...
Yeah.
There, noises at the table, bouncing your leg all the time.
Yeah. Sachs said a pretty interesting thing to me, and I don't know if he had written this or published it. It borders on maybe... easy to criticize, but he did point out that there is this middle area where you have girls that seem to be more tomboyish and more boy-like behavior. It has absolutely no indication that they aren't girls, it's just that they're girls that are like that, and they would rather do boy kinds of stuff than girl kinds of stuff. And you also have the other thing, which is you've got boys who are a little more like girls. They can sit, they can listen. And that's often where you see the greatest area of success academically, is because the girls who are, say, a little more competitive and aggressive can gain some benefit from that. The boys who are a little bit more just able to sustain long periods of attention and concentration can benefit from that. So he did point out that very often it's that middle zone where you see a slight academic advantage. But he also points out that one of the absolute biggest problems we have is the way to be successful in school. If you are a boy, the way to be successful in school is just be more like a girl. Sit down, shut up, smile at the teacher, answer questions, giggle, and don't move around too much, and don't make too much noise. And so a lot of boys in that environment are not free enough to be comfortable and happy and learning to their best ability. Yeah, kind of a sad story how, you know, so many of the schools that wanted to go with this, let's try to do, you know, separate but equal. Little interesting tiny bit of trivia here. Hillary Clinton, when she was senator from New York, co-sponsored a bill with a very conservative Republican senator from Arizona to assure the right of any school receiving federal monies to separate boys and girls, which is kind of the opposite of where you would look at your general liberal progressive position on that. Do you know why? Hillary herself went to an all-girls college, as did Madeleine Albright, Condoleezza Rice. You can name a whole list of very successful, well-known women who went to all-girls schools for part of their time. And they received huge advantage. Hillary understood the advantage of being in an all-girls college. Now they pretty much don't exist anymore. But it was interesting that she saw it and was willing to co-sponsor that particular law that protected schools from losing federal funding if they wanted to separate the boys and the girls. So, all right, well, we're at the end, and so we'll take a break. And I hope you have a good rest of your conference. Thank you so much for your attention.